Good morning, St. Louis. You are tuned in to the Home Improvement Show on KMOX, where we tackle all things home maintenance and remodeling. I'm your host, Rich Orris, here, and I'm here to answer any questions you make, anything on your home, anything you got going on. Let's make your home the best that it can be all the way around. Gonna love it, whether you're looking for anything. Maybe you got a leaky door, leaky window, you're updating your kitchen, maybe you're tackling some tricky remodeling projects that you just need a little advice on. So I'm here to guide you every step of the way, best as I can. I'll do everything I can, Scout's honor. So don't be shy. Give us a call right here, 314-436-7900, and let's talk about your next project. You bring the questions, I'll bring the know-how. Let's get started. Let's see what's going on out there. Hey, we already have someone jumping right in. We got Donna on the line. Let's get right to Donna and see what's happening. Donna, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm there. Oh, my gosh, I can't believe it. I'm so excited. I have a question that I just have been trying to figure out for quite a while. I've got a light fixture that is outside, an outside line.
Okay.
And it won't come on. So I'm guessing that it's just past its prime and I need to replace it. And, of course, I'm not an electrician. But I have seen people do it, and it doesn't look like it's that complex. You just take the fixture off, you untwist the wires, put the black in the black and the white with the white, and then probably caulk around it or something like that. Am I way off? So
no, you're really not way off. And the instructions that come with the light can guide you through it pretty well. The hardest part of changing one of those lights is that some of them kind of mount differently. Some have just one kind of screw coming through the center, and you put on a bracket, and then you put that screw through the center. But the instructions on each light fixture, if you follow through, shouldn't be difficult to do and to be able to get through. So changing an exterior light fixture like that is a pretty quick DIY project that happens all the time. Biggest thing I would try and make sure is to make sure that that's what's happening and what's going on. So I'm guessing you've tried to change the light bulb and
I did,
to
yes.
no avail.
And one of the things that I'm worried, the new bulb didn't work. But one of the things I'm wondering is if I just turn the switch off, then there's no power going into the lines. I'm not going to get shocked. I don't have to try and figure out which circuit breaker is going to it, since I can't touch it with a light bulb. I don't know how else to do it. Will that be enough to shut the electricity off to it by just flipping the off switch?
Yes, it will. I do kind of recommend, though, if you can figure out the breaker, that is a little safer. Just because if it turns on accidentally, it will be back on. If you just use the switch, I would put some tape over it.
Oh, good thinking. Okay.
While you're doing the work, just to kind of I don't know how many people you live with all that stuff, but I could see my wife walking by and just flipping the wrong switch on accident, and I'm on the other end of it. You know, just crazier things have happened, right? So be as careful as you can, but making sure that's the issue. So is that the only device that you've noticed that isn't working?
Correct.
Because checking the breaker box to make sure all the breakers are on.
Okay. Oh, I could do that.
Is a good thing.
Okay.
Because that, just to make sure that it's not a breaker, although your switch with your exterior light is not generally going to be on its own breaker. It'll be on with other things, so it seems like something else, another exterior light or something else elsewhere wouldn't be working too. But just to try and make sure, and the other thing that you can do is have the switch off, and you take that light fixture off, and you put a tester on the white and black wires on the outside once the light fixture's off, and you flick that switch and see if it gains power.
Okay, so what will the tester, does it like have a a dial on it or something, or does it light up, or what does it do?
So some of them have a little light bulb that lights up. There are testers, probably the easiest one to use, and they're not real, real expensive. There are testers that if you just push the button and you put it near the wire that has power, it will just start beeping.
Okay.
So if you looked for one of those, that would probably be the easiest way, is basically take the light down, flick the switch on, put the tester while you're holding the button near the black wire and see if it lights up and starts beeping. And if it does, then you have power, and then you know it is the light fixture.
So the black wire is the one that has the power. The white one is the ground?
Yeah, the white one is what they call neutral. And then there's usually a green. There's an open copper one for the ground, and that's what your green wire goes to. So you'll have just a copper wire, a white wire, and a black wire.
Okay. Copper wire, a white wire, and a black wire. Okay.
Yep.
And the green is neutral. Oh, the coppers.
The green goes to the open copper, the white goes to white, and the black goes to black. And that'll be in the instructions.
Okay. I think I got this. I'm going to give it my best shot. Thank you so much for your help. I'm very grateful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No problem. I appreciate the call. And, yeah, very eager getting in right away. So that was awesome. I appreciate you calling and getting in real quick. So got Donna some homework to do there, and hopefully it is just the light fixture, and that's very common, but could be the switch, something in the switch, too. So that would be step two. If that light doesn't work or if you don't have power, then now you're looking towards the switch. And if it's not the switch, you're going back towards the breaker and the wires in between. So once you get that far, I would say call a licensed electrician. You get beyond that, it's getting kind of beyond that DIY task there. So, hey, I think we'll get into our first break here, and appreciate the call from Donna. And remember, everybody out there, you can find me right here. We got a long show ready to go for you. I'll be here. Anything you need, 314-436-7900. Don't touch that dial. All right, everybody, we are back with the KMOX Home Improvement Show. Rich Orris here. And what do you have going on out there? What are you doing? Are you preparing your house for winter, maybe? You got a honey-do list you're rolling through. You're trying to do some last-minute things around the house outside before winter sets in and everything cools down too much to do that. So whatever the case may be, I'm right here. I'm your man. I can help you out. Anything you got going on around your house, whether it's remodeling, just some advice, some sort of maintenance, trying to change a light fixture, never done it before, like Donna there, we'll try and help you through it. 314-436-7900 finds me right here. Got a lot we can do and a lot going on, and a lot that we've done in the past. Last week, we had some really good calls and conversations about a lot of different common things that we go through, but we spoke about some moisture, condensation, water spots on a bathroom ceiling with Levon. So kind of went over why does that happen, how does that happen, what are some of the different things that play into making that happen on your ceiling, and some results for trying to make it better, see if you can fix it, from attic insulation, air sealing, bath fan, how you duct it outside, how you get through everything. So a lot going on there that we went over. And Sue had, she called in. She wanted some advice on removing some old a pet owner sticker from her door. And that I wanted to kind of remind again, because we've talked about it a couple weeks in a row here, but it's definitely a good safety thing to wear if you have stickers around your house for the fire department, how many kids inside, how many pets inside, anything like that. And you think about as circumstance change and you become an empty nester, making sure you update that, take those down, and have the correct information on there is just a great idea, really, for everybody's sake, especially those first responders that we have out there. So do that for them for sure. Michael had called in and he wanted some information about caulking his vinyl siding where it meets the brick. And there was a lot of talk back and forth and information there about where it's good to do that, where you can do that. Sometimes for aesthetics and where not to do that. There are places where there's transitions from vinyl siding to brick to roof to any kind of stone, any transitions there. There are places that you want flashing there, but you don't want caulk trapping water back there and in behind it. So we kind of went over all of that, and I like to revisit some of this just so you guys can maybe hear it, think about it. If you have a situation like that, you can either call in or you can go back and you can listen to some of the past podcasts and hear what some of those solutions were on there if you didn't want to call in. So we had a bunch of other stuff. Here was a real common one. Mike had called in and talked about filling in the dirt area in an atrium ranch. So if anybody's familiar with that, when you have the big glass wall in the back of the house and you have a dirt area by the stairs that go down to the basement and plants and trees growing and all of that in that atrium ranch, they call that. That is definitely something that is going away, and a lot of people wanting to get those filled in and reclaim some of that space, and just not really such a big feature anymore as houses change and times change. And if you think about trying a task like that, and we talk often about why does one project end up kind of having a much greater investment than the other when it can seem like kind of the same thing? And there's lots of reasons that happens, but one of them can be just the labor and how you perform it. So if you think about pouring a 10 by 10 concrete area, digging it out and putting rock in it, putting concrete, filling that in. Well, if you do that on your driveway, it's right at the front of the house. You can get the truck right to it. You can dump the concrete right in it. There's so many steps that make that easier. With the rock, you can bring a bobcat to dig out and move things and dump the rock. So you go around back, it can still be not as bad because you can drive things around. You can buggy concrete. You can drive things with the bobcat, the rock. Costs a little more because you're getting around and you're tearing up a little more yard and grassy areas. How do you get there? Now imagine you're walking through a 3-foot door in the back of your house to do that same task. Now you're really at hand at how the labor, you're bringing things in, bringing new rock in buckets. You're carrying things out in buckets. And it's just really so how that increases with that labor becomes really intense and can really cause a lot. So yes, going with new concrete inside a finished house basement with the access around back with no easy way to get to it. We find that a lot too with finishing basements and how we figure out how do you get things in and out, how do you perform it. Sometimes doing more work can actually save in the end where you think, well, but I'm adding expense, but you could be taking away so much labor. So I did a couple years ago, I did a golf simulator where we lowered the basement floor to get height to the ceiling for this golf simulator and to be able to swing a golf club inside a basement. So when you think about that, well, they didn't have a way in and out of the house. It wasn't a walkout. There wasn't any easy way to get all that debris out. And considering carrying that up the stairs and out through a very nice home and how you protect everything and all the stuff you gotta do. So and the funny part was it was also a room that you don't necessarily want a lot of light in, because when you're using this golf simulator, the screen, all that, it's a little dark in there, and you concentrate your light on where you stand and where the ball is and the mat and everything. Well, it was less expensive all the way around to cut out concrete and put in an egress window in a window well to get all of that debris out and get new concrete in to perform this work. So it's like you do more work, but it ends up getting rid of so much labor that it costs less. And labor is one of the founding fathers today of why things are still so expensive, with labor shortages and just trying to keep good people, and how labor has increased through COVID and over the past 4 or 5 years. It's gone up tremendously. So we really have to focus and watch that labor and watch how are we doing that. So there is a lot of examining, a lot of figuring out and going, well, how much is the egress window with the window well and everything? And will that save enough to get us in and out? And on that particular job, it did. It was a good thing. So thinking of all different ways to do something like that can be, it's kind of cool through the process and the designing and figuring out. And it comes to some great surprises that you wouldn't think that a lot of times, and comes up with some great ideas. And the funny thing on that one was we actually had to go back, and then we had to kind of black out that window. That we had to develop something that shades, like room darkening, almost black shades, a way to cover that window and fill it while you're playing and everything, so you're not getting too much daylight into that room and obstructing what we're doing. So kind of an interesting thing, but that's just how things happen, and it actually saves money and costs less in the end to perform it that way. So a lot of good things going on, a lot of good questions, conversations, a lot of good things we can do for you right here today. Don't forget, we're going to get into our middle hour break here, but you can give me a call. Anything you need, I'll be here for you. 314-436-7900. Don't be shy. We're here. Don't go anywhere. More to come after this. All right, everybody, we're back. Rich Orris here. Home Improvement Show on KMOX. And I'm here to help you, for you, anything you need. Call me. You can call me right here. You can call me right now at 314-436-7900. Whatever you have going on today, any type of DIY project, any maintenance, any remodeling, anything you just maybe want some advice on, that is why we're here, to kind of help out and give any kind of advice that we can help you with and that you may need. Anything you might be curious about, again, 314-436-7900 is where I'm at. So, and I had some really interesting calls of running around all week during the week for Mosby Building Arts, and going out and looking at people's houses and seeing what they have going on, and seeing how we can help in their different projects. And it's interesting, and I really enjoy it. And there's a lot of different types of conversation and a lot of explanation of when do we need what. We operate in many, many different ways. So, but there are times, even in some of the simplest things, that you still need to pull permits. You still need to go through the authorities and let them know what you're doing and how you're doing it and all of that, just so they know and understand and they monitor. And it's for everyone's safety out there, from yours to ours to everyone, making sure we do it right and get it right and it complies with everything. So there's different projects that people are surprised often that we do need to pull permits. And at times I get a lot of questions and conversations with, I'd rather not pull permits. A homeowner saying, what if we don't? I don't want to. Can't you just do it without that? And then I wouldn't need to do this or that. And really, it's the hard part with that is, one, it's for everybody's safety out there, including other people that come around your house and visit or any of that, and yourself. And it's a requirement by us, by Mosby Building Arts, and by all the remodeling contractors out there, to understand just when is that required. You can call, you can ask. So I just had one where we were kind of looking and having a conversation about building a carport in De Pere. And my first question that came up is, some places let you do that, some places don't. Before we get too far into this, let's have some conversations look into the codes and have conversations with the pair to make sure, if we can, that they will even let you do that. Because I know in the city of Maryland Heights, there's carports all over Maryland Heights. I would say 30% of the homes, if not more, maybe have a carport on them. But yet the code today is you cannot build a carport in that city. So that's particular to that municipality. So we found out we can in De Pere. It's not common for them, but they're like, yeah, no, you can absolutely have one, and we'll have to go through the regular permit process and all that. But it's good to find those things out and ask those questions. So understand whose responsibility that is, and that there shouldn't be a way around it. And I would question the people that say, oh, yeah, we just won't pull permits. That's fine. If you don't want us to, we don't have to. And that is definitely not the case. But, hey, we got Destiny on the line with the question for us. So let's jump straight to there. Destiny, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me? I'm here.
I can. Thank you for calling. What do you have going on?
Okay. Now, when I take a bath in my bathtub, okay, I notice that the basement floods. It causes a flood in the basement.
Okay.
So if I hire a plumber to fix that, what should I be looking out for when he starts talking to me?
So really, it's going to be just trying to track down where that water is coming from. And sometimes that's a little easier said than done or accomplished. But yeah, really the first part of what that plumber should be doing is just trying to figure out to find the actual leak. He'll want to fill that tub up, drain that tub, and see if he can track down where that water is coming from. Is your basement like open and completely unfinished?
It's not finished, but it's not a outside door. There's no outside door. You know, you can't come in and out from the outside.
Oh, okay.
It's enclosed. Yeah.
So there's stairs from the inside of the house to your basement, or is it like a short crawl space?
There are stairs.
Oh, okay, there's stairs. So yeah, he'll just basically start out with coming in and examining everything, seeing what he can physically see. And then step two is going to be filling up the tub and draining the tub to watch where that water is coming from. And it'll probably start just with the tub running, because sometimes you find it so fast, you don't want to necessarily fill the tub up all the way. But there's other times where your bathtub has an overflow. So there's a tricky leak in bathtubs that can be hard to find if it's a leak from while you're taking a bath.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the bathtub, there's that overflow cap kind of towards the top of the tub. And sometimes it's got the little flip switch on it that blocks the water so that you can fill the tub up. So,
okay.
And underneath that metal circle, there's an opening, and it's to a drain, so that when you fill that tub up past that, and it gets higher than that piece of metal overflow, it will start to go into the drain and drain out with the tub. And occasionally that's what leaks. So if you fill your tub up really, really full and your water level gets higher than that metal circle that's high up on the tub while you're in the tub, that could be a part of what's leaking and not necessarily the lower drain when you pull the plug and let the water drain.
So the
first step for that is let the water run and make sure the water stays under that overflow and see if you get the leak then. So when you take a bath, is it really, really deep? Do you know if it comes up higher than that overflow?
I don't know, but I just normally fill the tub halfway, maybe when I take a bath. But see, when I take a shower, it doesn't flood at all. Nothing happens when I take a shower. But I like taking baths, so
yeah.
I cannot because of the flooding in the basement. It floods the basement. But when I take a bath, I just do maybe not even quite half of the tub.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting conversation, the kind of combination of if it doesn't leak when you shower,
Right.
And it does when you take a bath, but you only fill that bath up halfway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not getting as high as that overflow. The shower and the bath draining will drain through the same pipes as you use it. So that's and that's how these get really tricky. So what you're looking for with when your plumber comes in is just somebody that's good, knowledgeable, and does a they'll do a lot of kind of things to try and figure that out. Running water, filling the tub up halfway, letting it drain. They'll probably want to fill it up as high. If they're not finding leak, then they'll want to fill it up as high as that overflow and see if something's going on with that. I had that problem in my house with my daughter's bathtub. That's what she was doing. She was filling it up so full, and every time I'm trying to find a leak, I can't find the leak until one day I figured out when she takes the bath and she fills it up so full, it's past that overflow. Mm-hmm. So now that pipe is more in the wall on the main floor than it is under the basement, you know, from the ceiling up. So mm-hmm. it caused a hole to fix the leak was going through a wall on the first floor in the hallway to get to that pipe to be able to fix that. So it can be tricky, and they may end up saying we need to get inside of a wall or something like that to kind of see and find it. So
mm-hmm.
But basically looking for a good, qualified, licensed plumber is the best thing you could do.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yes. Thank you very much. Have a blessed day.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for the call and the question. Good question. And it can be a tricky one. And water takes the path of least resistance. And we hear these, it's kind of like taking your car into the mechanic. And you're like, I always hear the sound or I always feel something kind of vibrating, and then of course right in front of the mechanic it's not happening. And that is an odd situation for Destiny, to where if you're only filling the tub up halfway and it's draining through those drain pipes, typically you would think it's going to do the same thing with the shower because it's water going into the tub and running down through the same drain pipe. So could be a little tricky for her to figure that out and get through it, but a good licensed plumber, we'll be able to figure it out, and we'll be able to get it taken care of. I know that for a fact. So, hey, let's get into our final break of this hour. If you have anything, if you need anything, I'll be here for you right after this short break. 314-436-7900. Get you right to me. Stick around. We'll be right back. All right, here we are. We're back. Final segment this hour, but don't fret. There's plenty of time now, and there's an entire another hour coming up for everybody. So you can give me a call right here, right now, 314-436-7900. Hey, these questions, these answers, it is kind of like a highway like that. There's so many different paths and factors and stuff that happens with all these different things. It's actually more common in a bathtub that we see leaks when the shower is running, but not when they take a bath. For Destiny, something I just thought of during the break was that maybe there's a crack in the tub, and when you fill it up halfway with water and put your body weight in it, maybe it's opening up somewhat and letting water leak through the actual tub itself, and maybe that's not as happening as much when you're just standing in the shower and it's not full of water, because there's a lot more weight, and water's very heavy, so that could be something that's going on with something kind of getting disconnected or a crack opening up and letting water out like that. But hey, we got Patrick on the line. Let's jump straight to Patrick and see what is going on. Can you hear me? Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you for your call. What's happening?
Well, I recently discovered that the vent in the second floor bathroom is just vented into the floor joists. It's not vented to the outside.
Okay.
And above the above the second floor, there's an attic which has partially finished space. So, boy, I just I don't know what to do other than just not use the vent fan in the second floor bathroom. Any suggestions?
And so that bathroom, I'm guessing, is a full bath with a tub, shower, your shower and everything in there. Yeah. So it is when you are running that fan and you have a lot of humidity and you take a shower, especially in the winter when you're dumping all that hot, warm, moist air into a floor joist cavity and it's not getting to the outside, that can create condensation and thing, all that happening, and maybe some stains that start showing up. And so it's definitely good to get it to the outside. But yeah, without examining the house and looking, because the other thing you got to watch for is if you found a way to keep running that exhaust pipe through the floor joist towards the outside, you definitely got to check the fan, the power of the fan, and how the instructions and how the fan says it can actually push air through a certain size pipe. Because with bathroom ventilation and with dryer vents, you can go too far and you'll get a long enough pipe where you'll never get air movement by the far end of the pipe. And the more elbows and turns you put in that, that kind of adds distance. It slows that air down. So you can do a shorter distance with a whole bunch of elbows and it still won't work properly. So I would definitely try and say, if there's a way to get it outside, that would be good. But without seeing the house and examining and trying to figure out a path or how it could happen, because it might just be opening up the ceiling in a bedroom next to it and running that pipe further until you get to that outside wall and punch it out through the wall. Or another thought is, if you go back down and across the bathroom and build like a soffit box on the bathroom ceiling and get it out a shorter distance, you'll add a couple elbows, but get it out a shorter distance to the outside wall, and you'll have some work with framing and drywall to kind of box around it and build a soffit to run that in to get it so you're underneath the floor joist. That's another thought of how you could get it outside.
Yeah. The outside wall is three courses of bricks.
Oh.
So
yeah, you're in an older full masonry home.
Yes, 100-year-old brick home.
Yeah, and that just kind of is what it is. And you can get through it, and you basically start from the outside, kind of drilling a hole where you want it to come through, and then you're basically just from the outside and the inside, rotary hammer kind of breaking through that brick and block to get that pipe out there and through there. Yeah, that's definitely a hard thing. The only other way you could try and do it is kind of like, instead of building the soffit to go through that wall under the bathroom ceiling, is running it up through the finish space somewhere, if that's a possibility, and kind of boxing around it like a post or like a box in a corner against a wall and get it up through the roof, but straight up, and then you're covering up that pipe in the finished area with some trim or some drywall or something to hide it in that third floor attic. That might be the other path too, to get it up through the roof, because that'll be an easier exit, unless of course you have a slate roof, because it's a older home. Oh my gosh. So then you're looking for a slate roof person. You might be better off with a brick mason going through the wall, really, and just hiring a brick mason to make that hole for you.
Okay.
Yeah, you got a complicated one there for what usually or should be a pretty simple task. But I would also advise that in doing anything to run that, make sure you're considering the condensation and the temperature differences and insulate the outside of that pipe, even if you're going to drywall over it or have it in a box or cover it up with some trim or something. Insulate that pipe wherever you run it so that it'll lessen the chances that you create condensation with temperature differences. When it exits the house, we also put a backdraft damper inside that pipe to where if anything happens to the damper on the roof or the wall, say that froze open or broke or squirrels started eating at the little flap and created a hole where air can just blow in, well, that backdraft damper will keep air from going backwards into that pipe. So it'll keep the hot in the summer or the cold air of the winter from going backwards into that pipe when the wind blows and everything. So there's good ways you can really set that ventilation pipe up for a lot of success in the future. Sound good?
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I enjoy the show.
I appreciate that very much. I enjoy doing it for everybody. I appreciate the very, very kind feedback there. So you got a strong task at your hand. And so we're going to get to our hour break here. We got Brad on the line. Brad, if you could hold through the break, we will jump to you as soon as we return after the news and everything. For everybody else out there, don't forget, you can jump in the next hour. A lot more to come. 314-436-7900. Don't go nowhere. We'll have a lot more for you after all this. All right, everybody. We're back for hour two. Hey, Rich Orr is here, Home Improvement Show. Want to welcome in the 97.1, or what they might call the KFTK crowd, with us here today for the second hour. Everybody, you can all find me right here, both stations, same number, one easy number, 314-436-7900. We'll get you directly to me. And we got Brad that just, like a stellar, held on through the whole news break and everything. Brad, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for hanging out through the news break and everything. What's happening?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure. So I have a situation that I'm trying to get some guidance on. I have a bathtub with a shower, and the water flow seems to be slowing down when you turn it on. You know, you have the knob in the center wall. It's a fiberglass bath tub, and on the spout, you go ahead and lift up the little pull button.
Yeah, there's like a button on top of the spout. Yeah, to divert
it. It up, and it slowly diverts the water from coming out of the spout and puts it up to the shower head. It seems I had a plumber replace the cartridge in the handle.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't seem to have improved it. So I was wondering if you give some recommendations as to what might be causing the water pressure in the other bathroom, and the sink right out next to it is running fine. So wanted some advice on how to remedy that.
So have you tried to check, has anybody checked the filter on the shower head when you remove the shower head from the pipe, and there's a filter in there that can get clogged with calcium deposits?
Yeah, and I have replaced the shower head a couple of different times, but that I could check that again.
Okay.
But it just like it's something with the I don't know how the diverter mechanism works, but it seems like it's when I lift it up, it makes kind of like a screeching sound as the water slows down and starts to go, eventually go up the wall and out the head.
Well, but is it when you do the diverter on the tub spout, does it completely stop the water at the tub spout?
Eventually it does, but it'll take about, I'd say 15, 20 seconds for it to finally get the water to stop there and to go up.
Yeah, and so I wouldn't think that getting a new tub spout with the new diverter on it may stop that screeching and make that water stop quicker. But it really shouldn't. Once it stops, it should have the same water pressure. So I don't think changing the tub spout with the diverter would. I think it would definitely help the problem with the screeching when you pull it up. That fixture's wearing out, and that's probably why that's happening. So changing that wouldn't be a bad thing for it'll cut the water off quicker and it'll stop that sound. But I don't think I'd be surprised if that changes the amount of water pressure coming through the shower head. And how old is the actual shower valve and whole shower system?
1988 was when it was put in.
So I wonder if some of it isn't because if you change the shower head a couple times and maybe there is a difference from the last time you changed it to when you changed it now, but shower heads actually have blocking and filters in them to restrict how much water comes out of them to simplify and lower water usage. So they'll only let so much water through it. So I would question too, is a maybe a portion of this just due to a newer shower head that's not letting as much flow through as an older one did?
Is that diverter? Is that I believe there might be a set screw underneath up against the right before it goes into the fiberglass. Is that how you change that diverter?
Oh, on the tub spout?
Yeah.
So yeah, they either screw off. Some of them screw on and off as they put like a pipe threaded fitting on them where the tub spout will actually screw on. But if you look underneath it, most of them nowadays, there is a little opening with a set screw for an Allen wrench, and it basically just slides over the pipe. You loosen that, slide it off the pipe, slide the new one back on, and then you want to make sure you kind of seal it, caulk around it, so you're not getting water between the tub spout and that. But yeah, so that's usually how those change out.
I see. Because I know we have very hard water, so there's a lot of calcium buildup.
Yeah, and I would tend to think you may even have some calcium buildup that maybe got in the pipe, and it's before on its way to the shower head, and it's kind of slowing it down. So it could be in the pipe. It could be before, as the water's going around to get up to that shower head. It could be away from that piece that got changed out in the actual fitting. It could be just above that in the pipe, and that's why it's still slow going up through there. So you really got to examine from the shower head all the way down to where that pipe connects to the valve.
Would you recommend, because of the age, having a plumber come in and replace the whole knob, you know, valve diverter in the wall there?
Yeah, because of the age of it, 1988, I would say it would be your answer that's going to correct it.
And they can pretty much usually replace that from if they were standing in the tub and work from that, or do they have to get to the back side of it?
Usually, they have to get to the back side of it and open up a bigger spot, because they got to disconnect all those pipes. And I'd also have them get to the back of it, because I'd recommend at least making sure that pipe is clear, or changing the pipe from the valve to the shower head to make sure it's a new clear pipe that's going to run.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now they try to pour some. Back in the day, we would with older pipes, we would try to put muriatic acid in there to see if you could break that up and get it to pressure out of that pipe if there's any in the pipe. But that was with older pipes in older downtown buildings and stuff. But that might be a theory somebody recommends too.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those are all good ideas.
Okay. Yeah, we got some tough ones today. I'm glad I can help. But yeah, there's a few of you out there that got your hands full trying to figure this stuff out. But I'd go with the new valve and change that pipe, and I think that's your best answer to getting to the truth of all of it.
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate it. Yep. I love the show.
Oh, I appreciate it. Definitely appreciate the kind words. Thanks for calling in, Brad. We've got Donna and Robert. If you both can hold through a quick little short first break of the hour here, we'll have plenty more to come, and we'll get to both their calls plus everybody else out there. 314-436. Get you right to me, 7900. I'll be here. Don't go anywhere. All right, St. Louis, we are back. Home Improvement Show. Rich Orr is here to help you out. You can give me a call. Don't forget, we've got plenty of show left. 314-436-7900 finds me, just like Donna found me. Let's get to Donna and see what is happening. Are you there, Donna?
Hi. Hey. I am. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking the call. I'm very grateful. I have a leak that comes in my basement, and I think that the source of the water is the gap between my concrete garage floor and the concrete parking pad that butts up to it. So I caulked it with a concrete siliconized filler and sealer, and it seemed to help it. And then a little more rain came in, and I noticed that it was cracking the sealant, the siliconized sealer. So I put more silicone on it, and it cracked again. So I did a third time, but I'm thinking maybe I just need a different type of compound or something.
Yeah.
It says it's for concrete, but since it's cracking, I think the water is still getting in between those cracks.
Yeah,
any
yeah.
Suggestion?
Yeah, no, there's definitely most concrete caulks are a urethane base, so they're more kind of sticky and they're not as rubbery as the silicon type caulk is. So yeah, there's concrete caulk, and some of it is what they call self-leveling, and basically it just means it's really runny and it'll kind of level itself out. And then there's the same thing, and it's just a thicker type of caulk of the same system that doesn't level itself out. You got to control it and tell it how you want it to be on there. But that caulk should last better than the silicone on concrete. So, and they do make a primer, kind of like a cleaner. So you want to get rid of all of that silicone that you can and really clean that concrete off. You want to get it back to the bare bones of concrete to concrete. And caulk it with a more of a urethane-based concrete caulk.
I want a urethane-based?
Yes.
Okay, so underneath all these layers of this stuff that I've used is wood. So, you know, there's like about, I don't know, a half inch or 3/4 inch of wood breaking up the concrete garage floor versus the parking pad.
Yes.
Will it work on top of that?
If you have the space, it will. So the question would be, how far down is the top of the wood from the level of the concrete floor in the driveway pad?
At a guess, I'm saying about a half an inch, maybe.
So that's good, because you want at least 3/8 to a half of an inch of space for that caulk to fill up, because you're trying to get that caulk to grab the sides of the concrete.
Well,
so that being a half inch down is good.
In some spaces, it is a little less than that, though. But
yeah, so you would want to get that out of there so that you have the proper thickness.
Oh, should I chisel some
down.
Of that wood
off? So you would chisel some of that wood off.
Okay.
Or the other way that you do it is, because sometimes that wood will come loose, so you take that wood completely out of there where it's like gone. You just pull the whole thing out, or it's broken off to where it's an inch down or 2 inches down, and they make a foam rope called backer rod just like it kind of sounds, backer rod.
Okay.
And, and you measure the width of that opening. So say that opening is 3/4 of an inch wide, then you would buy a backer rod that's a little bit bigger than that. So you can kind of tuck it in there, force it in there tight, and then you can put your height with that round rod for how much caulk you need.
Is that backer rod like a foam hose kind of like?
Yep, it looks like a foam garden hose, and it comes in every imaginable size.
Okay.
From like a 1/4 inch circle to 1.5 inches or something like that.
Okay. To fill in the gap, if it's deeper than, say, 3/4 of an inch.
Yep.
If the gap, okay, put that foam rope in there, and then go ahead and put the urethane concrete caulking.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And they make a primer. It's kind of like a bottle of cleaner that has on the lid. It's got the little brush, and once you clean all the caulk and everything off, you can put that primer on that concrete and let that dry, and that'll give it a really good, clean area for the caulk to stick to, because you want about 1/2 inch thick layer of caulk sticking to the edge, the side of that concrete.
Okay. And will that also help bond it to the wood that'll still be there that's a little deeper?
It won't really probably help it too much with the wood.
Oh, okay.
But the sides is really what you're concerned about, and the wood, you just need the wood or the backer rod there or something there so that you're not just losing the caulk or using too much.
Got it.
Because it'll just fall in. So you're trying to get the proper height for filling that.
Okay.
Yep. Just don't want to waste it.
Thank you so much.
Yep. You're welcome. And just ask for a driveway caulk and just make sure it's not silicone. Make sure it's like a urethane. All right.
Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Let's jump over to Robert. Kind enough to hold for quite a while there. Robert, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Rich. Looking for some guidance and direction. I've got a townhouse, the air conditioning unit's about 20 years old. We've nursed it through the end of the summer and the fall, and I know it's time to replace it. I'm hearing all about the transition of refrigerants in 2025.
Yep.
And so the question is, do I buy now and take advantage of lower costs? This is what I'm hearing anyway. Lower costs, refrigerant that will expire over the next, I don't know, 30, 40 years, they're saying. Or do I wait, get stuff with a new refrigerant, and then how do I choose which type? Because I think there's 3 refrigerants out there. So just looking for some guidance as to how to make a decision.
So, yeah. So the good thing is the refrigerants, even the oldest refrigerant is still around.
Mm-hmm.
So these refrigerants do stay around for longer than the lifespan of a AC unit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking at it investment wise, because what I'm hearing is that the cost of the AC units, not only is the cost of the refrigerant going up and how you work on it and fill it later, but the cost of the new unit is going up anywhere from like 15% to 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got an AC that costs $4,000, it could cost $5,000 in January.
Right. And then,
so for me, I would do it as fast as possible.
Okay. And the new ones, mm-hmm. I'm hearing there's like 3 different flavors is what my term of refrigerant. And then is there going to be any direction as to narrowing down to a single? Or is there always going to be multiple options moving forward?
So that part I have no idea about, if there's going to be just narrowed down to one or not. To me, it's going to work fine. It's going to be good, and you're going to be able to get that refrigerant if you need to work on it or do anything with it. So from an investment standpoint, I would do it before the end of the year.
Awesome.
And save 25% or 15 to 25 or even 30, whatever they're predicting here. And just, I would take that route with the age of it and everything, because you're definitely going to get into it.
Good. So, well, you've affirmed kind of where I was leaning. It's just kind of hard to sort through it when you're just by yourself looking online. So
yeah, and what I in the conversation I had with the trade partner that we work with all the time at West County Heating and Cooling, because I did talk to him about is, well, what's the difference in the new refrigerants and like running and working, and and he's basically saying that it's not a matter of it's going to cool your house any better, it's going to be any more more energy efficient or anything like that. You can still get a good energy efficient, you can still do all that, and it's going to work and function just as well. The old refrigerant might end up costing slightly more down the road, but your savings could be way more than you would ever spend on that.
Awesome.
Later on.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the show.
All right. Perfect. Nope. Not a problem. I appreciate the call. Good calls, good questions. We got some tough ones today. We got some people with their hands full with some of these leaks and bathtub problems and water problems. And if you have any problems, if you got anything going on, anything you need help with, we're going to get into another break here, but you can find me for the next half hour, 314-436-7900. Don't go anywhere. More Home Improvement Show to come. All right. We are back. Plenty of more Home Improvement Show for everybody here today. Rich Orr is here for you. 314-436-7900 is where you can find me. So we've got a call on the line, but I don't have a name on it. We just have a number. Okay, we're typing in a name. Here we go.
It's pronounced Huey.
Oh, Huey's on the line. So we got Huey on the line. So is it Huey Lewis in the news?
I wish. Yeah. Maybe less famous, but I'll take it.
But yeah, I'm with you.
And I can't sing, so there's that.
Well, me either.
I have a 1950-ish Cape Cod in Webster. Trying to fix up the front of it a little bit, and I noticed that the kind of like the front fascia has that aluminum trim on it, and the fascia board underneath it can in not the greatest condition, but I can probably scrape it and paint it. But I'm wondering if I take off the aluminum trim. Mm-hmm. I don't want to put aluminum back. What are some other viable options I could use to cover the fascia with?
Well, really, it's between the aluminum or a painting, some type of painting. Like you can go with like a Rhino Shield if you're looking for you want the wood look, you like the wood look, you want to paint it and have it last a really, really long time.
Okay.
Then that would work, but there's really not a lot of, I mean, other than changing the board itself out, but anything you replace the board with goes back to either something that's pre-finished that eventually you'll need to paint. It goes to kind of a painted product.
Yeah.
So, and there's really not much else.
Is that why the aluminum trim is the key to so much of this finish work?
Yeah, because there's this story or what everybody asks for is maintenance free, and nothing's really maintenance free, but the aluminum, although it might need cleaned up and that sort of thing as a maintenance package, it really takes a lot of years for that to start oxidizing or get to where it needs to be replaced. Uh-huh. And so it's just less maintenance while you have it. And people just don't like to get out there and paint as often as they used to, which hence goes towards the better paint, like the Rhino Shield, and get the paint to last 20 years or so, like that aluminum will, and people really like that. So it's kind of between one or the other, but that's why that aluminum's so popular, because you don't have to paint it. It looks good for 20 years or so. And you just put it right over top of that wood fascia board, and you're good.
Is there any kind of PVC or I was doing some internet research, of course, because I'm now an expert YouTube expert. Is there a hardy side option that can go on top of the wood, or would that just be blending too many materials together?
Well, what that would do is it. it thickens that fascia because it's like a board on a board, and you mm-hmm. need you require and need so much roof overhang over that board.
Right, right.
So like a hardy board or something like that of the same thickness, you want to take off the wood and then put the hardy on, or there's composite boards you can use. But all those boards, you either buy them pre-finished the color you want and end up needing to paint them at some point, or they're all a painted type of material.
Okay.
So even if you get a pre-finished hardy board, or and there are other types of boards out there like that that you could get in different siding makes, but they're all like a factory painted that they claim will last 15, 20 years, something like that. But the warranty on them are prorated, and it is a paint that's applied in a factory, so it's a better paint job, but it still wears down like a paint job. So eventually right. it will need to paint. And if they say you've got a 20-year warranty, well, it's a prorated warranty. So if you notice you need to paint in 10 years, then they're going to, what you get out of them from the warranty is very little, because it's a portion of that warranty and the time. And they kind of go, well, it should cost this much. And you do that. And then they just write you a check for some painting that's way less than you need to actually do the painting, because it's a prorated type of warranty. So it's just a matter of the look you're going for and if you're okay with painting or not.
Right.
Now,
I don't have a big deal with painting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The only other thing I would recommend when you look at either wrapping it with the metal, or the same theory with like the Rhino Shield type paint, because that paint's, it's not really paint, it's like a coating. And it applies on there and makes like this coating that doesn't breathe. So like if you have gutters, you want to take those gutters off to put on right. that aluminum coating, or take them off to do that Rhino Shield painting, because you'll get the paint all the way up to where you need it, or you'll get the metal all the way up to like the roof shingles. So if you put gutters on top of that, if those gutters overflow, they're not getting to the wood behind the aluminum or the paint. Because once it gets to the wood behind the aluminum or the paint, it'll rot worse and it'll rot faster because it can't really breathe. So aluminum does the same thing. If a lot of houses I've seen, they leave the gutters on, they tuck that aluminum to cover that wood underneath the gutter, but that doesn't go all the way up higher than the gutter, because there's gutter fasteners and all that. So they just tuck it up there about an inch. Well, any water gets behind the gutters, or any time the gutters overflow, you end up with your water getting behind it and rotting out wood. So that's the thing you got to be careful. Both good products, you just got to make sure they're applied the best they can be all the way behind the gutters and things like that, so that you don't have issues down the road.
So the Rhino Shield product you're talking about, is that a big box item, or is that the something?
No, that's a company. That's a company that they. It's like a ceramic coating paint, and it's very durable, and it will last a very, very long time, as long as you don't get a bunch of moisture vapor or moisture trying to come out from behind it. Keep the humidity level down inside your home, because you've got a coating on it that's not letting it breathe real well.
Will they sell that on a consumer level, or would they only apply it?
No, they only apply it. I'm pretty sure that is they come out, they do the painting, the applying, all of that, and then it lasts 20 years or so. It's a great product.
Can I tack on one more question?
Yeah.
I don't know if you have time. I have the Cape Cod I'm talking about has metal siding. When we bought the house, they did a pretty poor job of painting it, so things are peeling off. So I would like to repaint it by prepping it correctly. But is it advisable to paint metal siding? Is that okay to do, especially if it's going to be a darker color?
Yeah, no, it's fine to paint metal siding. Yep, it's all in the cleanup, the prep. making sure it's going to adhere. You prime it well and getting layers that will stick very well. Yep.
Great.
Yep, and that Rhino Shield, I don't know if they put that on metal or not. That might be a good question for them. Because that's definitely something that if they got it to stick well, it'd be great on that.
Yeah.
Because it's metal, yeah. All right.
All right, thanks for your answer.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for the call, Huey. I appreciate it. Good questions, good topics, good answers. We're going to get into our final break here. Last segment coming up. If you need something from me, 314-436-7900 will get me in the next segment. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Camo X Home Improvement Show. Rich Orris here for you. And we've got two callers on the line. We've got Steve and Steve. So we're going to flip a quarter and go to Steve, and then we'll go to Steve when we're done with Steve. Hey, Steve, you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am. Thanks
awesome.
Very much.
Thanks for calling in.
So a few years ago, my son-in-law and I took on a home improvement project where we remodeled my master bathroom, took out the old basic construction-grade bathtub shower kit, threw it out, and put in just a stand-up shower, and tiled the walls, and put in a nice barn door sliding glass curtain, and everything looked great. But ever since then, I've had a mystery drip coming out of the bottom of it, and I can't find it. We had gone through and it had grouted all the tile in place, so I removed all the grout from the bottom of it where the pre-poured flooring, the floor pan, met with that and caulked it instead of the grout.
Uh-huh.
But every once in a while, I still have this just mystery drip. I've actually never, the master bathroom overhangs our garage, so I've never closed up the ceiling in the garage because every once in a while, I just find this little drip. And I can't tell where. I haven't had a plumber come out and inspect everything, and we've opened up the wall and can't find anything leaking anywhere, but yet every once in a while there's this drip. So
okay.
I've been hesitant to close up the ceiling, and I'm just not sure what more, where I can look at it or where I can find it from, if you see if you had any thoughts.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Is the shower floor, is that like a mud set pan with tile also?
No, the shower floor is actually, it was a Lowe's product. It was just a pre-casted single piece.
Okay. Yeah, so it's just like a white shower base, and then you tiled the walls. Did you?
Right.
What did you put behind the tile? What kind of product?
Actually, I think we just tiled over the old drywall that was there, and I've not seen anything from it. I didn't tear up the old drywall to put in concrete backer board, which I kind of thought maybe I should have, but I just tiled over the old drywall that was there.
Okay. And then did you tile in any sort of like a soap recessed niche where you put shampoo bottles and anything like that inside the wall?
Yes, we did. I built a small 12x12 cavity in there and then just used the 1x1 pre-squared boxes, so it was a perfect fit right into there too. So that's all tiled in.
Okay. So
and I don't see evidence of water leaking through that anywhere.
So yeah, because that would be another spot where there's like a flat area that if the inside corners or the grout was letting water through, it could go down the wall where that shower niche is kind of recessed into the wall. So that could be an area of taking out grout and caulking those corners, inside corners, and making sure the grout and everything's solid there. But with the drywall backer also behind that tile, it really could be anywhere in that tile to where any type of crack or break in the grout is going to let water right through that backer and be able to come down. And have you thought about kind of trying to monitor when you see it and maybe when you don't? Because it's like a shower that there's a couple different people that shower in there, so maybe it might leak when you're in there but not when somebody else is?
I've gone as far as to turn the shower on and hose the whole wall down and stand underneath and wait for the drip, and I never find it. And then every once in a while, I'll just see, water dripping.
Yeah.
So it's just this mystery phantom drip that just keeps me from closing up that ceiling in the garage. I even wondered if it was so much of maybe just some condensation might be getting on those pipes since the ceiling itself is actually open, and that's where the drip is coming from.
And that's a possibility, too, being over a garage if there's a big temperature difference, monitoring when you're seeing it, what the temperatures were like, was it really cold, was it really hot, that sort of thing, that might kind of narrow down finding too. But I'm almost willing to bet with the drywall backer and everything that it's somewhere in the shower door, the caulking, the corners. There's something around there I'm almost willing to bet. Or that shower niche that sometimes water is getting to it and it's just seeping through there a little bit and letting it go through. So it's almost got to be something like that. I'd check around the shower door and everything too, because if it's getting behind the door and through a screw hole to the wall or at the bottom corner where the bottom door track meets the wall track and it's getting between the tile of the wall and the shower base right at that corner, that could be another spot where it's coming out.
Okay.
So I guess it's somewhere in there like that. All right,
appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. Good luck finding that, and kind of monitoring and looking as much as you can is going to help. So let's go to Steve, the second Steve. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I love it.
All right, no problem. What's going on?
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about surge protection and whole home surge protection.
Uh-huh.
What is your thoughts on it? I've been an electrician all my life, and in fact, I got to warn you that I am actually an owner of a company called Surge Medic, and we put in surge protection devices in for people for home surge protection. So just wanted to know your thoughts on it. I know it's a... it's a standard now. The NEC has put it out that as of 2020 that each home should have, and especially a new home being built, should have surge protection. Just wanted to know your thoughts on it.
So my thoughts would be that I would probably certainly guess that in the next 5 or 10 years, I think every 3 years or so, something like that, is when they look at upgrading codes, the IRC books, and what codes we're following. So I would definitely guess that in the next 5 to 20 years, it will be a requirement when building or when changing out your panel box, pulling permits to upgrade electrical and everything. So it will definitely come into play more and more with new things we build and new remodels that we do or while we're changing panels. And I think it is a good thing. It's not... it's not like it happens a lot. It's not like it's something that happens a ton to people where their house gets damaged like that. But when it does, it's like catastrophic. You get hit by it. I mean, it's so big. So you get too big of a surge coming backwards, it can really cause a lot of issues and a whole lot of money for insurance and everything and computers and TVs and everything you got around the house. Nobody unplugs anything.
Right. One thing I've noticed as an installer of the, we put a Tesco unit in, and it's a, it goes on your panel. But I've noticed that a lot of people are getting, like their computers and stuff like that. Well, this has a 10-year warranty, but
hey, Steve, I apologize. We're completely out of time. I got about 10 seconds here.
Okay.
But I appreciate the call, and I agree. Get the surge protectors. They're a great thing. They will help protect you. And again, for everybody out there, be good. Be good to each other. Be good to your homes. And I'll talk to everybody next week.